distinguished guests, members and their guests, the National Press Club today welcomes as its guest speaker American mining expert Mr. Eugene Chiccioni. He is editor of Mining Engineering, the monthly journal of the US Society of Mining Engineers, and is in Australia at the invitation of the Foundation for Economic Education Australia to gather material for the January 1977 issue of his journal. Mr. Chiccioni will speak to the club on the theme of, quote, the vanishing freedom of the press, end quote. During his visit, he has been very outspoken on problems facing the mining industry and the world's economics generally. And to set the scene, let me quote some of his comments. Some of these were issued to the Parliamentary Press Gallery yesterday. For example, governments can cure inflation if they really have the will to do so. Another one, mining companies and industries generally are too timid in their dealings with governments. Further, the mining industry should neither ask for nor expect favours from governments. And finally, I just quote, the unions are likely to intensify their campaigns against Australian mining companies. I now invite Mr. Chiccioni to address the club. Following his speech, there will be the usual period for questions by our press and media members. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hawkins. To borrow a phrase from the Democratic presidential nominee, Mr. Jimmy Carter, who's a southerner and speaks with a southern accent, quote, before I start my speech, I want to say something. I speak as an individual. I don't speak on behalf of any organization that I might be associated with. In fact, I can't even speak on behalf of my editorial staff. Since my subject is freedom of the press, I will first examine the current status of freedom of speech in such semi-free countries as America, England, and Australia. And I will then examine what is being done to the press in other countries. In America, freedom of speech is guaranteed by the First Amendment of our Constitution, which states unmistakably that, quote, Congress shall make no law infringing the freedom of the press and of religion. You would think that with such a constitutional guarantee, the U.S. government would never dare to infringe our freedom of speech, right? Wrong. Freedom of speech in America is gradually and constantly being eroded every day. The attack so far has never been overt and direct. It has been more deadly than that because, like an invisible but kind of a poisonous gas, it hits you before you're even aware of it. Now, the U.S. government attacks freedom of speech indirectly by means of regulation. For example, when we Americans wake up in the morning and we turn on the radio and listen to a radio station, or we turn on a television and watch a station whose personnel are aware that the government may put them out of business if they run afoul of government regulations. So, while newspapers and dailies, magazines, still enjoy relative freedom of speech, radio and television do not, because according to Washington bureaucrat, you see, when the Constitution was written in the 18th century, the Founding Fathers didn't say anything in the First Amendment concerning radio and television. Government regulation, incidentally, has already been extremely successful in silencing almost anyone in America who is engaged in the creation, production, and exchange of values. What evidence do I have? In America, there is a government publication called the Federal Register. It lists all the rules and regulations issued every day, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year, by the hundreds of federal agencies in Washington. In 1965, for instance, the Federal Register consisted of about 14,800 pages of fine print. Last year, it had blossomed to 60,000 pages, that included more than 25,000 new regulations. Now, parenthetically, you might be interested in knowing that according to Murray, Weidenbaum, quote, today the cost of federal regulatory activities is rising faster than the sales of companies being regulated, unquote. Murray Weidenbaum ought to know, until 3 years ago he was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. For obvious reasons, it is extremely difficult, in fact, it's impossible, to enforce hundreds of thousands of regulations that nobody can even keep track of, let alone understand or obey. Now ask yourself what this kind of madness achieves. There can be, and there is only one result, the selective enforcement of these regulations against anybody who, for one reason or another, dares to displease the authorities. And this is how American businessmen, once the most outspoken group of people in the nation, now keep silent to the public, or to the extent that they say anything at all in public, their utterances are extremely timid and shy. American businessmen are scared to talk, and their input to the media has been decreasing substantially over the past few years. The selective enforcement of hundreds of thousands of often incomprehensible regulations, which are also contradictory in that if you obey the dictates of one federal agency, you may well violate the commandments of a dozen other federal agencies. The result of that is tyranny. A tyrannical government operates in fear. American businessmen are afraid. And the American press is quickly losing access to businessmen who, out of fear, have embraced a policy of corporate self-censorship in order to survive. Now, everything I said so far about the United States applies in spades to countries such as England and Australia. Both England and Australia suffer from a similar, if not worse, dose of bureaucratic overregulation. In fact, during the past 5 weeks that I visited your country, the favorite phrases of Australian businessmen had been, don't quote me on that, this is off the record, not off that. In England and Australia, freedom of the press is under attack not only by big government, but, as you know, also by big labor unions as well. In England, for instance, the National Union of Journalists, which is the official union affiliated with the Trades Union Congress, lobbied very successfully last year, and earlier this year, with the Harold Wilson government, in order to pass into law the Trade Union and Labor Relations Bill. This bill, and now I'm quoting from the from an article that Frank Jackson published in the Australian, March 25th, 76. This bill enshrines the closed shop. Quote, under the Trade Union and Labor Relations Bill, editors lose the right to solicit articles for their newspapers from outside the industry. They can continue to do so only with the compliance of unions working in the industry, end quote. Frank Jackson also continues the report saying that four Yorkshire journalists, upon passage of the bill, left the National Union of Journalists in protest and joined the rival Institute of Journalists, thereby incurring the anger of the NUJ, which then called a black ban against the four defectors. In regard to attacks against freedom of speech in Australia, you'll probably remember the black ban imposed last year by the Transport Workers Union against Dr. P. Gill Hubbard, who dared to speak publicly against Medibank. Quoting from the Sydney Morning Herald, June 25th, 1975, quote, the union's Tasmanian secretary, Mr. J.C. Rolfe, said the ban would compel Dr. Gill to recognize the fact that unionists and the community at large want Medibank. The ban would immobilize Dr. Gill. It would be impossible for him to go interstate by air or sea, and he should have difficulty buying petrol. The union will black ban drug houses which supply it knowingly, as well as many retail businesses. The union is seeking the assistance of other unions to have Dr. Gill's mail service stopped and his phones left unprepared. Mr. Rolfe said the ban would stay until Dr. Gill changed his attitude, end quote. I spent some years in Sicily, incidentally. We have the mafia here. Dr. Gill's crime was his exercise of his freedom of speech. For that crime, the Transit Workers Union punished him by depriving him of his livelihood, at least making him try it. Max Harris, commenting on this incident in the O'Shelley, July 5th, 1975, said, and I quote, "If it has many unbanned as possible and uncondemned, then there is no reason why any public commentator, author, or politician should not be next. Or for Catholic bishops or Jewish rabbis to have supplies cut off unless they abnegate the right to express their opinions. Arbitration judges could be black banned for their judgment and decisions. It's the first thin end of a totalitarian wedge," end quote. According to Max Harris, the victimization of Dr. Gill was greeted with a deafening silence. Fortunately, however, the Australian press screened Bloody Murder a few months later in 1975, August, when the then Minister for Media, Mr. Moss, Dr. Moss Hass, put forward a proposal whereby recalcitrant newspapers would be forced to toe the line by starting a research unit, quote, to investigate, monitor, and report on press performance, and then also to create a press licensing system for newspapers. This license, this kind of licensing from the government to publish what the government sees fit to be published, would be granted, suspended, or withdrawn on the basis of community satisfaction with performance. So this reminds me, America, of the Supreme Court law against obscenity. They couldn't deal with it, so they dumped it on the lap of the state governments and municipalities. Furthermore, going back to Dr. Moss, quote, "Direct constitutional impediments could be circumvented by imposing conditions on the input of newsprint or by imposing selective taxes," end quote. It's pretty much the same thing that Salvador Allende did in Chile. You see, he didn't eliminate freedom of press, he just put a quota on newspapers. If you didn't like that particular newspaper, well, you know, sorry, buddy, but you don't get your quota of paper this week. Commenting on this proposal, the Australian, in its August 11, 1975 editorial, said, quote, "What country are we living in? It sounds more like Dr. Goebbels, Nazi Germany, than Dr. Cass's Australia. You know, is Australia supposed to go the way of Portugal, where the first target and victim has been the leading socialist daily newspaper, or India? And what is it that makes a research team more capable of, quote unquote, monitoring the press than the newspaper's first client, its reader, who simply stops buying when he is dissatisfied," end quote. Meanwhile, the unions keep up their little tricks, and you may remember the black ban that was imposed by the Waterside Workers' Federation on the shipment of newsprint to the Melbourne Herald, when the Melbourne Herald dared to run articles on industrial troubles at the waterfront. All these incidents, bad as they are, become insignificant when compared to the massive body blow aimed at freedom of the press by 58 of the so-called underdeveloped nations this year. As most of you know, the 58 developing nations under the auspices of UNESCO have formed an international press agency pool that will, in effect, create a cartel on all news within their countries. Their respective government will have exclusive control of all news within national boundaries and will also censor any news that comes and goes from the outside. National censors will have exclusive power over the information flow. They'd first be linked to regional groups and then in global ones. Foreign correspondents could face arrest for their reports, or even for the way their papers back home handle their stories. The outside world would know only what the censor wanted it to. Or if you will, one half of the world won't know what the hell is going on in the other half of the world. What I find shocking is the fact that this enslavement of the press of 58 nations has received the blessing of the United Nations. A protest against the United Nations on the part of your government, my government, England, and a few other civilized nations would be an exercise in futility. I would suggest, however, that both our respective governments, Australia and the US, immediately cut off all financial support for UNESCO. That's the least we can do. Better yet, I think we should withdraw our membership from UNESCO. Now there is a very important point for all of you to think about, and it's the following. The UNESCO thought controllers have attempted to justify their action by asserting that communication is, quote-unquote, a vital national resource. And like other national resources, it must be government-regulated. After all, national communication, they say, is public property, and only the government can regulate and control public property in the public interest. If you have noticed, all of the rip-offs, expropriations, and nationalizations that have been perpetrated by all, and I underscore the word all, governments, in the semi-free countries, as well as in the left-wing and right-wing totalitarian regimes around the world, have all been made possible because of the widespread acceptance of the collectivist concept of public property and public interest. I submit to you that a collective or public property is a contradiction in terms. Who is the collective or the public? It's everybody in general and nobody in particular. And what is property? On moral legal grounds, the concept of property identifies the relationship that exists between a man and an object, or a value. And the law in civilized countries clearly spells out the method in which a man acquired title and possession of a particular object. At this point, I want you to consider how each one of us would fare if, let's say, in a moment of madness, my government or your government were to nationalize our mining industries and place them in the limbo of public property. Suppose you wake up broke one morning. Would the knowledge that you own a share of this mythical public property be of any help to you? In the first place, how much of it can you call your own? None of it. Where is your share of it? Nowhere. If you either want to sell your share or buy somebody else's share, where is the market? No such market exists. If you think that such an expropriation is unlikely, brace yourselves. I'm here to tell you that a similar type of nationalization has already occurred in the United States. From 1968 to 1975, the U.S. government has withdrawn from mineral exploration nearly two-thirds of all the so-called public land in America. In effect, American mining companies have been forbidden exploration in two-thirds of the country. Now, this is the same as the government forbidding doctors to do medical research on two-thirds of the human body. I repeat again, the entire concept of a collective of public property is a contradiction in terms. Even in science, you see, there is no such thing as a collective property of the elements. There is no such thing as a collective density or a collective viscosity or a collective molecular weight of substances. Now, what is a collectivist government's answer for this? It sounds something like, well, it's human rights that we care about. Human rights take precedence over property rights. Mind you, this is the only instance in which right-wing and left-wing collectivists all of a sudden show any concern for human rights. That argument doesn't wash because human rights cannot exist without property rights. And we know that it is impossible to have the human right to freedom of the press without your right to own paper, a printing press, and ink. There can be no freedom of speech without the right to own meeting halls, microphones, radio stations, TV stations, and picket signs. There can be no freedom of religion either without the right to own churches and religious books. There can be no political freedom without economic freedom. To repeat, human rights cannot exist without property rights. To bring this fact a little closer to home, without property rights, Australia will not have a viable mining industry. I guess you might have a mining industry, sort of, in that case, but it will be, in that case, just about as efficient and as profitable as your railroads and your post office system. So far, I've used the term freedom without defining it, so I think it's time to identify it. Biologically, freedom is an immense capacity to raise this level of awareness and face facts and respond to them. This ability to respond to facts is why a man is held responsible for his actions. Freedom and responsibility are two sides of the same coin, but who the hell wants to be responsible for his actions today? Labor unions? In my country, they often blackmail an entire community and go on strike at the drop of a hat and are able to avoid the consequences of their actions by getting welfare payments, state aid, and maybe even unemployment compensation. Big businessmen? Most of them have forgotten that ours is a profit and loss system. It's gotten to the point that if your yearly losses are big enough and run into the hundreds of millions of dollars a year, and if you and your management team are incompetent enough, then your business survival is assured, because if Washington hasn't already done so, it will bail you out and keep on bailing you out. Witness Lockheed, Penn Central, Franklin National, New York City, and so on. Today, nothing succeeds like a grandiose failure. And what about our intellectual leaders, the academicians? In my opinion, they are the worst. Thanks to federal aid to higher education, a lot of them are eating out of the public trough. They know a good thing when they see one. Perhaps a free press, or what's left of a free press, could be the best and indeed the only hope we have. Freedom is not an abstraction in some platonic dimension. It is a very real property of the individual and essential for survival. If we are deprived of that meaning, if we are deprived of our right to think and to act, we cannot acquire and use knowledge. If we cannot acquire and use knowledge, we cannot survive. It's as simple as that and as complex as that. Politically, what the hell does freedom mean? It means the absence of coercion. A society is free to the extent that coercion is absent, and in a free society, the only role of government is, in essence, a negative one. In a free society, the government tells, as long as your actions do not infringe on the rights of some other body, you can do anything you want. In a semi-free society, which is what we now have, government pays lip service to individual rights, but then proceeds according to the philosophy that as long as I, the government, have the support of the majority, anything goes, because you must do whatever the majority wants you to do. And this is where, particularly in the realm of pure and applied science, everything goes crazy, because neither an individual nor a majority of individuals can dictate terms to reality. In the words of Francis Bacon, nature to be commanded must be obeyed, meaning no problem of technology or engineering or biology or ecology has ever or will ever be solved by force or by majority vote or by minority schemes or by parliamentary law. Politics is one thing, science, pure and applied, is another. Mix them and you destroy both of them. The marriage of politics and the science of ecology, for example, as not and will not produce a cleaner environment. It has merely converted the science of ecology into a tragic joke while saddling the American system with the Environmental Protection Agency, which is a bureaucratic nightmare with the potential for destroying every industry in the country. Or to give you another example, if you consider the marriage of politics with the science of economics, this marriage has not brought the millennium to any country. Instead, it has gradually converted economics from a science into a dismal science, and then into a batch of incoherent slogans, while perverting economic thinking into the orgy of good intentions that are paving the way to the hell of labor monopolies, industrial cartels, declining industrial productivity, unemployment, confiscatory taxation, inflation, and bankrupt currencies. In this century, we have moved away from freedom and individualism. Not that we ever achieved those two ideals, but we came pretty close to it in America. The name of the game today is coercion and collectivism, of course, for the public good, for the public interest. The same philosophical framework from which you can whip off everybody. Within this kind of a context, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, that kind of a freedom is doomed. I tried to show you the writing on the wall. If we are truly concerned for human welfare, if we really care for freedom in all of its aspects, we have to rediscover again what freedom and individual rights are all about. Socialism, be it left-wing socialism or right-wing socialism, alias fascism, and it is towards fascism, a benevolent form of fascism, that we are galloping towards in the United States, neither brand of socialism is the answer. The answer, I believe, was originally put forth in my adopted country, the United States, where capitalism, in the very brief period of its very much maligned life, relieved more suffering, brought more wealth, and more happiness to more people than all the prophets, saints, politicians, statesmen, reformers, and do-gooders put together. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kisiani. I now invite the press media members of the club to address questions to you. If they please give their names and that of their organisation.
Quite what the radio say. It's been reported from America today that the American consumer advocate Ralph Nader has warned the Australian government against mining and exporting uranium. He says it's a venture fraught with danger. Judging by the tone of your speech, I dare say you'd agree with that. Can you tell us why? I'm sorry, you would not agree.
The function of government is to protect every individual's right to his own life and to his own property. Wherever pollution exists, be it nuclear or otherwise, that is precisely the kind of damage it does. It infringes your health, it fouls up your property. Ralph Nader is an exception in that, because all he's interested about is the public good. His attitude toward many public issues, for instance, nuclear energy, is totally negative. He doesn't quantify anything he says. He makes qualitative statements. Ralph Nader used to be an expert in automobiles. As a result of some of his design changes in automobiles, we wound up in the early 70s with some sort of contraptions on cars that allegedly reduced the emission of hydrocarbons, but at the same time converted our automobiles into perambulating sulfuric acid plants. Ralph Nader is not a nuclear physicist. Now, when it comes to nuclear energy, let's not forget that that is an industry that was sired by government. Government has a vested interest for national security reasons, for military reasons, to make nuclear industry look good. In the words of that famous British philosopher, John Lennon of the Beatles, whatever the government touches turns to shit. Look, when it comes to the mining of uranium and to the processing of uranium ore to uranium oxide, that activity is just about as dangerous as the mining of copper or lead or zinc or any other hard rock. No, in fact, less so, because most of the uranium mines in the United States, with the exception of one single mine in New Mexico, are surface mining operations, earth-moving operations. The processing of 2-yellow cake, that's a straightforward proposition. It's elementary chemical engineering. So, when it comes to nuclear reactor design, Mr. Ralph Nader simply hasn't got his facts straight. He should consult the Lucent report that was put out by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and had the contribution of our leading nuclear physicists. I'm not an apologist for the nuclear industry. I think that we can pretty well fill our energy gap by coal and conventional fossil fuels and and there is time with the new things like solar energy and so on.
As Max Horgan, Brisbane Telegraph, could I ask, you've seen a lot of our Australian mining industry development in the last few weeks. How efficient do you rate it? Do you believe that tax incentive subsidies are necessary for our industry in Australia? And what are the differences in the rate of encouragement by perhaps governments or other between Australia and elsewhere in the world?
Well, in the first place, I don't like to confuse a tax incentive with a subsidy. A subsidy is what you get with the proceedings from somebody else's taxes. A tax compensation is what you get in the way of government, may I please have a little more of my own money. Now, when it comes to that, I like to look upon it sensibly. Corporations, mining companies, and so on, business in general, do not pay taxes. That is merely a carried cost, all up and down, from production to marketing. The people who pay taxes are people like you and me. The ultimate consumer pays taxes. I'm against any kind of favoritism to any industry. What was the second half of your question?
Well, how efficient are we?
Extremely efficient. The Australian mining industry is very, very efficient, of course, within the constraints imposed by your labor unions. Again, when it comes to labor unions, I cannot find any fault of the union leader who wants the greatest pay for his members, who wants the best possible pensions and fringe benefits and so on. This is what I want for myself. This is what each of you want for yourselves. The trouble is when they start telling industry what you may or may not produce, what you may or may not ship in which particular type of bottoms, you may or may not say in your own newspaper, that kind of thing. When they get into those areas and they try to pose a statesman, I think that's where the disasters come. So within the constraints of the labor situation in Australia, the Australian mining industry is very efficient, surprisingly so.
The third point was about the differences of encouragement in Australia, say, with governments as elsewhere in the world.
I don't know about the mining industry of the world at large. I only know a little about the mining industry in the United States, and I think that, by and large, the Australian mining industry doesn't have the kind of crippling controls that the Australian mining industry has. However, if things keep going the way they are, you will very soon catch up with us.
Alan Fitzgerald.
Alan Fitzgerald, TCA. Mr. Gutierrez, I think you overlooked two problems relating to the first question that you were asked. The first one is the problem of storage of nuclear waste, a byproduct of nuclear energy. We had an American out here the other day who seriously suggested that Antarctica should become the dumping ground for the world's waste because there is no safe way of storing it. And secondly, I don't know whether Mr. Maynard's objection was related to the problem that so-called peaceful uses of uranium are very adaptable for the purposes of the manufacture of nuclear weapons rather than having a nuclear power plant. It's fairly easy in the next stage to produce a nuclear weapon. So are you really endorsing the mining uranium unrestricted, the export unrestricted? Are you endorsing the proliferation of nuclear weapons?
Did I say all this?
I'm asking whether you
advocate. No, in fact, I said the contrary. I said that the nuclear industry is a creature of government, and I expect nothing good to come out of any government whenever the government goes beyond its moral, ethical functions. And I haven't talked about those functions, but you'll find those four functions in the text of my talk. Look, in a way, this is the same sort of controversy that went on all around 1860 or 1861 when Alfred Nobel was able to stabilize trinitrotoluene, TNT, on Kieselguhr. Well, all sorts of people got upset, oh, this is immoral, it's terrible, it's going to unleash wars, which it didn't do. And the thing is this, there are peaceful uses for TNT, there are military purposes for TNT. To the best of my knowledge, people don't declare war upon one another. Corporations don't declare war upon one another to the extent of shooting each other. Unless they happen to be, you know, Sicilian mafias or that type of thing. It's governments that declare war. And this is why I had the plant in my talk to the effect that once you begin to mix politics with any aspect of science, pure or applied, you destroy both. Historically, whenever any branch of science has come under the thumb of either political orthodoxy or religious orthodoxy, you've seen the death of that science. 450 years before the birth of Christ, we had a fairly valid atomic theory of the elements. It was shut down by the Platonic school of thought which was then later embraced and smothered, I might say, by Christianity. And for about 22 centuries, no metaphysical investigation of matter was possible. So all I can say is that it is a moral problem, and I wouldn't try to look at government as the ultimate arbiter of morality. The arbiters of morality in the absence of this wasteland that we have should be us, people in the media.
Could I just ask a supplementary question? I mean, the problem of the disposal of nuclear waste is a practical problem, not a moral one.
Right.
In your country, I believe, private enterprise is involved in the manufacture of nuclear energy. It's not a government process.
Well, I mean, private enterprise in America is just about as independent of government as Eliza was independent of Simon Legree. When it comes to nuclear waste, I don't take the expertise of a nuclear physicist such as Ralph Nader. I rather listen to what Dr. Edward Teller has to say about it, and I question specifically about a year and a half ago, Dr. Hans Bethe, who also participated in the Manhattan Project. He's a Nobel Prize physicist. I have an interview here that I published in Mining Engineering with Hans Bethe. I didn't even bother reporting on this nuclear waste problem because at the time it wasn't an issue. It has been popularized in the past 8 months. The reason I didn't even bother reporting the question and answer regarding nuclear waste was because Hans Bethe said this is the non-problem of the century. We can take all the nuclear waste from all of the existing and projected nuclear reactors from now to the year 2000 and encase them, I suppose, in the volumes of just about the size that was the room in which he was talking. Put it in cement. If you feel paranoid about it, you can put a casing of steel. Put it under an underground salt dome. And then you can sleep next to that steel casing and receive less radiation from that than you would by sleeping every night with your wife or your girlfriend. Because you see, all of us have radioactive potassium in our bodies, and we tend to be radiated one another. Now, of course, Ralph Nader says one thing, Hans Bethe says another thing. As a man of science, of course, I tend to favor Hans Bethe, just like if any statement says that such and such a politician said so and so, and then the politician says, oh no, that isn't true, I was terribly misquoted, so and so on, well, I'll give you one guess as to which guy I'm going to trust.
We could open questions up to some of our non-media members, as we don't seem to have too many here today, but can I ask again, on the uranium question, what you've seen some of our mines and potential mines in your travels here. You know that, of course, this is a subject of an inquiry, Mr. Justice Fox. What potential do you see for Australian uranium mining and exportation if the government agrees that it should go ahead?
Well, it isn't true that I have seen mines. Oh, yes, I've seen one mine, that's Mary Kaplan, and one uranium oxide production facility, also at Mary Kaplan, which compared to the uranium facilities in New Mexico, aroused profound indifference in me. It's an old plant, it was 12 years of mothballs. All the rest are not mines, they are deposits. And nothing in mining is worth anything until somebody with some knowledge goes in and gets the stuff out of the ground and puts it in the market. What will happen to it? I don't know. Some of your unions are against nuclear energy. So, it's really a question that will be settled between the two groups, and the one who has the biggest club will win in the end. Between a fight between a government and a labor union will always be won by a government. In Nazi Germany, there were fights between the Nazis and the labor unions, and the labor unions lost. That's the history in this century, and of course, I'm against government. So
I don't know what answer to give you. If the government wants uranium, the Australian government wants to have a uranium industry, you Australians will have a uranium industry, regardless of what I or anybody else says.
Peter Samuel. Peter Samuel, I was preparing to ask you the question that Lennon asked, what is to be done, in particular about trade unions. If I might just interject a small personal experience, having become rather critical of the role of unions, I decided about a year ago that I should cease to be a member of the union myself, having been one just by force of habit previously, and so I wrote a letter of resignation to the Australian Journalists Association, and they refused to accept that resignation and told me that in fact I owed them, if I wanted to resign, I had to pay 3 months beyond the date of my resignation.
On what?
So I paid them. I paid them 3 months extra, and they then still refused to accept my resignation. And a few months later, a man bashed on the door, and he had a warrant. And so now I'm being taken to court, and I shouldn't say any more about it. I have a court with the Journalists Association.
Did you get to the point, please?
My question is, given the power of unions in modern society, particularly Australian and British society, the fact that employers are fearful of employing people who don't belong to unions, that unions have taken on the power of deciding where electricity power stations should be, what our trading policies should be, whether historic buildings should be retained or not, almost everything you like to mention. You know, what on earth does the individual do apart from trying to resign from his union?
Precisely what you're doing. Scream your head off, goddammit!
Yes.
Do you think compensation should be paid to Aboriginal communities for mining, uranium mining rights, first of all? And secondly, if you believe no government interference in mining, should Aboriginal communities have the right to stop such mining?
I don't know about the Aboriginal issue in Australia. I know that in America, our Indians, and perhaps you have the same situation here in Australia, American Indians were relegated, were whipped off immensely by the US government. And then they were relegated into various reservations in various states. Then some mining companies discovered that those areas had good ore bodies, and they went there. They dealt directly with the Indians. As a result of that, there are more millionaires per 100 Indians than you find even in such a city as Dallas or Houston, Texas. So I don't know what property rights the Aborigines have. You see, whenever any country is sliding either towards left-wing totalitarianism or right-wing totalitarianism, or middle of the way totalitarianism, it doesn't matter whether to have one dictator or 63 or 70 or 535. What happens is the first thing that flies out of the window, property rights. So, do the Aborigines have property rights? That I don't know. In the United States, at a time when there was still respect for property rights, the Indians got a very good deal from the
ownership.
I was wondering if you could tell us when the United Nations as a whole endorsed the proposal for the information article, and also how do you justify the withdrawal of substantial aid to an organisation such as UNESCO, which has many aims apart from promoting Latin American conferences?
Latin American conferences for what?
Well, what was the one that proposed information?
Well, actually, I heard a report in New York, I forget the source of my information, that cartelization of the news media, that monopoly, if you will, has been in the works at UNESCO for 4 years. Well, if it were up to me, in New York, I lived in New York for 22 years, our little pet name for the nations was that goddamn history by debating society. It's a total waste of time. Look, for instance, at Israel. In that miserable place, Israel is just about one of the few civilized countries in that area. What was the attitude of the United Nations? They accused the Jews of being genocidal. This is when Pat Monahan, who was the U.S. ambassador to the UN, got fed up and started yelling, and he eventually resigned shortly after, when, at least from what I could infer from the newspapers, he got in trouble with Henry Kissinger on that.
Lee Capno, AP Dow Jones. Has Australia missed the boat, in your opinion, on uranium as far as world markets are concerned? Is demand for uranium already receded?
Australia has not yet missed the boat, just like the United States has not yet missed the boat on developing its coal reserves in the western states. But the thing is that in the western states of the U.S., we haven't done anything with Western coal for 6 years. And as far as the uranium deposits of the Northern Territory in Australia are concerned, Australia hasn't done anything about those deposits for at least 3 years. The people that I've talked to could have gone into production, mining and production, at the tune of at least one company, I won't close its name, could have started producing 3 years ago at the tune of 3,000 tons per year. So, if there is a green light issued today, they'd rather borrow uranium from other countries, from the British Atomic Energy Commission, in order to fulfill their contractual obligations with outfits like Southern California Edison, because you see they cannot ship Australian ore to the United States because the unions are against it. So it all depends on the outcome of this Fox Commission and what it will be, who knows.
Any other questions, sir? Perhaps I could ask if you could perhaps further explain that last quote that I used, that you stated during your tour, that unions are likely to intensify their campaigns against Australian mining companies. Could you explain what you sort of see in this and why?
Max, I don't remember where it was or in what context I said that. If I could remember the context, but, you know, I tell you, I frankly don't remember.
Well, I'm fighting your foundation there,
not just education.
Oh,
I don't know where they got it from.
Oh, well, that's propaganda. But look, things always
stand. Your sponsors.
Yeah. I don't speak on their behalf.
No, so.
What happens that the way things are going, they're going to get worse before they get better. So just judging in general, you know, as a rule of thumb, I would say that, labor unions will continue to give trouble to the mining industry, not only in Australia, but in America and so on. Here in Australia, it's a little worse because your labor leaders somehow got bored with attending the welfare of their members, and they all want to be statesmen. Well, if they want to be statesmen, why the hell don't they run for office?
Mr. Gutierrez, because of recent fluctuations in the price of gold, the gold mines of Kalgoorlie seem likely to close down, and that will mean major unemployment in this significant West Australian town, which may become yet another ghost town as a result. The mines are asking for government assistance. I gather you would suggest they shouldn't get it.
That's right.
What should happen to the town and the people who at present live there?
Division of labour. They can... it is incorrect to say that gold is the only thing in Kalgoorlie. A few miles south, there is the Kalgoorlie Nickel Smelter. That smelter did not exist prior to 1972. A little further south of Kalgoorlie, there is some nickel mining operation. Yeah, Kambalda. And north of Kalgoorlie, or about, I would say, 200 miles north, northwest, there is Windara. There's another nickel deposit of western Maine. If the Fraser administration is able to cut down the inflation rate, after all, Jerry Ford, who according to the American media, is a fellow incapable of chewing gum and walking at the same time, was able to cut inflation in half, Mr. Fraser, who is a much smarter man, should be able to eliminate it altogether. So if he is successful in doing that, there will be a fantastic mining boom in Australia. Capital will flow in. And, also in Western Australia, there is an enormous amount of iron ore. Whether that will be developed or not, I don't know. A good part of it has already been developed. Mount Isa and Mount Newman and Goldsworthy and Rogue River. But there's still much more iron there that can be developed. So it's a question of, right now a commodity is going down, so devote your energies and efforts to do something else.
Mr. Gucciani, I was just wondering if you think of anyone in particular when you're talking about labor states.
the only person I can think of when I talk about labor unions or labor statesmen is George Meany, who is president of the American Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO. I don't know what the CIO stands for. George Meany is about 84 or 85 years old. He is a grand old man. He suffered in his youth. The feelings I have for him are a mixture of respect and frustration. Frustration in the sense that, he has his own background and his own way of thinking. I have my own. I was born and raised in fascist Italy. And what terrifies me is that the labor unions are their own worst enemies. They keep advocating more government intervention in this industry, that industry, that other industry. Governments like to intervene. They like to build the powers of the union. When you are in a situation where the ideological milieu is such that you no longer have classical socialism, that is where the government comes in, expropriates, works off, nationalizes, and you see that is unpopular, because after the government nationalizes a particular industry, then the industry becomes a Frankenstein. Instead of producing profit, it produces losses. That is, it's another burden on top of the taxpayer, on top of the consumer, so standard will be dropped down. However, the trend today is toward right-wing socialism. Another name for it is national socialism. Another name for it is fascism. Under fascism, you see, you don't have to expropriate anything. You can achieve exactly the same purposes by controlling everything to death. So by controlling, then you as the government, in those few instances in which things go well, you can take the credit for it. When things go badly, you can always blame private industry or the Jews or some other convenient scapegoat. So that is the system in which we're going. We are going toward right-wing socialism. And what happens is invariably that whenever you establish even a benevolent form of socialism, when the time of crisis comes in and there is a confrontation between the government and the unions, then the government will seize, appropriate, or if you will, nationalize all of the powers that the unions have worked for decades.
Yes, could you give me your name, sir?
Yes, sir. Richard Shearer, Canberra Times.
Richard.
Do you think people have any right at all to determine the use of technology in their own country? And if so, how do you justify your statement that science and politics don't mix?
Scientific questions cannot be settled even by majority vote among scientific experts, let alone by majority vote among scientific illiterates. When it comes to the truth and validity of a scientific concept, the number of the adherents or opponents is entirely irrelevant. In science, be it pure or applied, something is either right or wrong, true or untrue, valid or invalid. There is no such thing as in science something being liberal or labor, democratic or republican.
Finally, Aaron Lloyd.
Lloyd, ABC. So you describe yourself as a chemical engineer first, I think, and a journalist second. Could I ask you a question, if you put yourself in the position of being a prophet? When our coal and uranium do finally run out, what does the world turn to then for energy, and how much longer have we got?
We have approximately until the year 2000. We will not be running out of coal by the year 2000, but in the United States we'll just about run out of uranium, that is, at the current grades of uranium ore by the year 2000. Now, by the year 2000, we should have in operation the Rida reactor, which produces more fissionable material than we are actually consuming. Now, every time that the Rida reactor is delayed by 5 years, this will impose enormous burdens on the mining industry to go ahead and find more uranium ore bodies. Well, all of the high-grade uranium ore bodies, at least in the United States, have been found. So this means we are going to have to mine the lower-grade Tennessee ore bodies. Tennessee has nothing to do with the state of Tennessee. That's the name of the geological formation, where uranium concentration is of the order of 200 parts per million. Now, if you're going to mine uranium at 200 parts per million ore body, then you will really see a devastation of the countryside on a massive scale. And this is why I'm skeptical about the good intentions of the so-called environmental leaders also, who are opposed to the development of the Rida reactor. The result of that has been that even a country such as England is years ahead in research and development in the Rida reactor than the United States.
Mr. Cucciani, I'd like to give you the opportunity of suggesting that removal of the foreign investment guidelines might stimulate activity in the Kalgoorlie area to the extent that gold mining would not need government assistance.
I don't agree with that at all. American companies are not as disturbed about the foreign investment guidelines as I thought at first blush. Mm-hmm. Moreover, when it comes to gold, that commodity has always, within memory, always been under the thumb of governments. They are playing games with gold right now. The drop in the price of gold is an artificial one. It is a natural one. It is an unnatural one. It has nothing to do with the free market or any other commodity you care to think of.
Thank you, Mr. Cucciani. I'd now call on Mr. Alan Fitzgerald, the immediate past president, for me to vote of thanks.
Well, actually, I can't let the opportunity pass without making one observation. Mr. Gucciani, you said that human rights cannot exist without property rights. Unbeknown to yourself, you're obviously visiting the unfree capital of the Western world, because here everything is leasehold. We don't have freehold rights, including the ground on which this club is built. So there you have it. And also, it's a city in which only 40% of the workforce is employed by private enterprise. So it just shows you how unfree we all are. But I would ask members to show their appreciation to our guest and the customary now.
It's ready? Okay, to start off where I left off. Up to the time of the Industrial Revolution and of the American Revolution, wealth was accumulated by military conquest, by rip-offs, by theft, by debauching the currency, usually by metallic adulteration, shoving in copper and brass into gold, and eventually winding up with copper coins and so on. And also by physical labor, which meant, in 9 cases out of 10, by slave labor. The Industrial Revolution changed all that, because for the first time in the history of mankind, a human being could harness the power of steam so as to produce work. So you were no longer physically limited to how powerful your muscles were. You had the mechanical extension in the steam engine of the power of your mind. And then by hooking it up to textile factories and so on, productivity increased, you know, sort of doubled or tripled every 5 or 10 years. Okay. So the lesson was that wealth could now be obtained by creative ability, by productive ability, and by the use of machinery that liberated man from the parameters of just his own body. Now, the mind became very, very important, because intelligence paid off, knowledge paid off. So, unfortunately, what happened at the time was that all of the thinkers of that period, all of the 18th century thinkers in Europe, did not realize the importance of the Industrial Revolution. They did not become aware of the impact that the American Revolution was having. And you cannot blame the thinkers of the 18th century for their failure to recognize what was going on. After all, communications were not then what they were today. So the only thing that they did was they realized that more wealth was being circulating around, more wealth than ever before, but they were unable to understand where it came from or how it was being generated. They merely looked, observed their own particular systems of government, which were just a variation of a feudalistic totalitarian system of government. Then they also looked back in history, and they found that really all the various governments, all the various societies were organized on slavery. Were all different versions of totalitarian regimes in which a society was divided artificially into exploiters and exploited, into the haves and the have-nots, in the blessed and the damned, in the word of St. Augustine. So, they said that to cure the inequities, what was needed now was a massive redistribution of wealth. About two generations later, in the middle of the 19th century, around 1850, I believe it was, that idea was popularized by Karl Marx, who saw everything in terms of economics, in terms of the power, the established elite, and the working classes. And he saw everything within the context of a class struggle, a class warfare of the proletariat against the state, or against the vested interests. So he came up with big system whereby there would be a struggle between the proletariat and the aristocrats, and this also fitted in with its own particular hang up with Hegelian philosophy that saw everything in terms of a thesis and an antithesis, and then out of this fight between the thesis and antithesis there would be a new synthesis. The new synthesis in the case of Karl Marx was the classless society. The state would vanish away, and that everybody would live in some sort of Marxist paradise. Now, since Karl Marx observed everything in collectivistic terms, he never took the role of the individual into account, what happens is that once you have a movement that has all the best intentions in the world and tries to do things for the benefit of the proletariat, or even for the common good, if you don't like that word, proletariat, The fact is that there is no such thing as the public out there that you can point your finger to. The public is merely the sum total of every individual in a particular society, and this is something that our founding fathers knew. If you want to achieve the public good, you must first ask yourself what is the good of the individual. And when it comes to that kind of a question, that is a question of morality. And morality always involves a choice. And morality is always something very, very personal. So, by protecting the rights of the individual to his own life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, the right to his own property, and otherwise leaving men free to pursue their own improvement, this led to the common good to an extent that it never before that had never been seen in history before. So, what's involved in the process of production? Well, take for instance this idea that a lot of mining people have about natural resources. They seem to think that once a natural resource, meaning a particular ore body, has been exhausted, that's the end of the cycle. You have to start looking for other resources. They're right in that, but they have a rather materialistic view of what wealth is. The root of wealth is the mind of man, its knowledge. That isn't enough, however. You've got to have some sort of a natural resource out there that you recognize as a resource, then you have to apply your knowledge to the problem of production in order to convert that particular ore body into a marketable or commodity. So what's involved in the process of production and the process of creating wealth is, first of all, you have to have people who know, who have the knowledge. They also, well, for instance, the example I usually give is that of the surgeon. Okay, what is his particular resource? Well, it's of course the knowledge that he acquired in medical school and the skill that is in his hands. He didn't get this ability overnight. It took him several years. So the fact is that at the end of his training, this particular resource that he has in his mind and in his hands will be totally worthless and useless to him and to anybody else unless he puts it to work. Then after it starts working, this is when the benefit will accrue to himself and to his fellow men. In this sense, there is no such thing as a natural resource. All of the rocks and the dirt and the underground matter that you find, all of those things are totally useless and valueless until somebody with the knowledge comes in, is willing to work, and starts producing values. And in the problem of production, the questions that you're always faced with ultimately boil down to either-or type of propositions. Is it right or is it wrong? Is this true or is it false? Is it real or is it unreal? Is it valid or is it just my wishful thinking? So these are really ethical questions. So whoever the producer happens to be, he has to have the honesty to ask those kinds of questions, to phrase those questions in that form. And then, after he has found the answer and proved that the answer is correct, he has to have the integrity to put that answer into effect, to execute it. So, what's involved in the process of production, to summarize it, is knowledge, reason, logic, honesty, and integrity. I mean, it's the best in a man that's involved in the process of production. So, we, the producers, are being accused of being materialists. But we're not materialists, because you and I know precisely how little that stuff in the ground is worth until we start making something out of it.
Sure.
Now, we are being called materialists by the type of people who are experts at a different type of materialism. That's the dialectical materialism, which is the stuff that comes out from all of the spiritual descendants of Karl Marx, the socialists, in effect. They are the dialectical materialists. To them, the process of wealth creation is a big, big mystery, to the extent that they ever think about it. They usually say that wealth is created by the worker. That's nonsense, because if wealth were created by the worker, all that you would have to do is to look at those countries that have the greatest number of workers. India, China, those are not rich countries. So, it's just wealth depends on the individual and on how free he is to do what he wants with his own resources, with his own intellectual resources. So, the best thing is to aim your pitch at the people who are the producers in your community. Even though they might have entirely different political views than your own, the best thing to do is never to make a frontal attack, never to say, well, I believe that so-and-so is the case. Start by asking the man, for example, your opponent, let's say, what are some of the problems that he has in his own business? And then you tell him on your own what are the problems that you have in your own business, sort of swap notes. And then as you draw the man out, to the extent that he has any acumen at all, he will realize that quite a number of problems in his area, in his work, stem from some sort of goddamn law, either at the state level or at the federal level. Could be that some of the problems are due to competition. Well, in that particular case, you tell him, you try to find out from him whether this competition, or rather the uncompetitive place in which he has been put, was caused by unearned favors that his competitors obtained from the state, or whether his lack of competitive savvy is due to his own incompetence, or not necessarily incompetence, or whether he isn't quite as smart as the other fellow. So if the other fellow is smarter than he is, or even if he works harder than he does, you tell him, look, this is a fact of life. And if your other guy is better than you at doing a certain job, well, you can do the same thing. Or if you cannot do the same thing, then what's the sense of your wasting all this time and energy hitting your head, so to speak, against a stone wall? Why don't you go and work for him? Learn from him as much as you can. Then after you have learned, then you can go somewhere else and set up shop for yourself. You'll have a brand new market, and you can make a success of yourself. So it's the idea of getting the other fellow to tell you what kind of problems he has, even if he has entirely different political ideas than you do. Once you know that, you already have a great deal of insight about the man that the man himself never had and doesn't have as yet. So these are the tools that you have to work with. Mm. And in the process of talking to a local businessman, you know precisely what are the problems that he's faced with. Then to the extent that you get involved in the inside workings of your own industry, the moment that you have to talk, let's say, at some annual meeting of the dealers, the Automobile Dealers Association in Western Australia, you will know precisely what's bugging them, and then you can work out the analysis. You can trace, well, this is when they introduced the tariff against imported cars, and this is what the tariff has done. This is how much, this is the income level for our customers in this particular area, and this is how much our automobiles are costing, and at these high prices, we cannot possibly sell all of our output. Let's see what we can do. Well, maybe we shouldn't have such high protective tariffs for Honda bicycles or for Volkswagen or that sort of thing. We should insist for a lower tariff. And then you can make the moral case against tariffs. And for that, you find your material in Ludwig von Mises. Even Adam Smith speaks very eloquently about that. Mm. So the other guys are going to listen to you. You talk the same language. You are aware of their problem. And before you know it, they'll be agreeing with you. And one manager says, so to speak, I'm using your name just as an example. Then they will start following you. You are the leader. You are the recognized authority in your field.
Well, that's a good point. Rather than create this, I think the other people on the other side create enough divisiveness and enough conflict between the various groups of people, especially in Australia. Your idea is not to dissipate our energy on frontal attack, but just to take the thing from around the side, win them over one by one.
Yeah, work with people in your own industry first. Now, this is something that dentists should do, that physicians should do. Talk to other physicians, for dentists to talk to other dentists, and so on. And when you talk to labor people, by all means, agree with them immediately that what you want is exactly the same thing that they want. What you want is more money, more vacation, more fringe benefits, and so on. But the point is, look, we got to make it first before we get it.
Right.
And when it comes to making it, to make them understand that if they were working in an anti-capitalistic society, a typically anti-capitalist society would be India. All right. Why is the productivity of Indian labor so abysmally low? And this is because the amount of capital invested per Indian worker compared to the amount of capital invested per American worker, per Australian worker, is extremely low. In America, for instance, in the petroleum industry, each worker, on the average, in the petroleum industry, has an investment on him of about $50,000. If you take a big petroleum refinery that cranks out, let's say, 100,000 barrels of crude oil a year, just as an example, that refinery might be worth $50 million and they might have 500 workers. Well, in that particular case, $50 million divided by 500 workers, well, you figure out what is the amount of dollars of capital invested per worker. So this is a good rule of thumb. But the thing is this, that and it has been proved for so many times in this century that I feel dumb even talking about it. But the thing is this, productivity is primarily a function of how much capital has been invested by managers per employee. By just pushing a button, for instance, at a computer, programming operator in the United States makes anywhere between $15,000 and $30,000 a year, depending on how sophisticated his job is. Now, he does that with virtually no physical labor at all. He just pushes a few buttons. And the main resource that he has is in his brain. And if you look at the hardware in terms of IBM computers and so on that is there available at his disposal, that adds up into hundreds of thousands of dollars. Where did that money come from? That came from retained earnings. That came from profit. That came from the savings of individuals and corporations. And this is when you, you know, start telling people that capitalism is nothing else but your reinvestment of your own money into the machinery that is going to increase your productivity and that will give you all the good things in life that you want and that I want.
Gene, you've shown how all of us, all different sectors of this, of the community, are really in this together, and we should be working together rather than against one another. I appreciate your comments. Thanks very much.